Shalom Harav Arnix. Welcome to our next session in the first regathering, Zionism and Modern Israel. We're in session number 20 as we look at Israel present. So let's review where we were in session 19. In session 19, began in 1996 when Ehud Barak took over the Labor Party leadership. Then in 1998, Israel turned 50, and we looked at a number of indicators of Israel's growth over the years. Total population, military strength, tanks, warplanes, active armed forces. And then we looked at some private civilian gains in prosperity, number of telephone lines installed, the number of private cars on the highway. And then we looked at the number of native Israelis, the Sabras, in the country. In 1948, Sabra population was only 26.3% of the total population, but in 1998 it had risen to 61.2% of the total population. So large gain in native Israelis, Sabras, in the country. We also talked about the pluralism fight, where the ultra-Orthodox Jewish men, Israeli men, and I should say the ultra-Orthodox Israeli community clashes with the atheistic agnostic community. The Y River Memorandum was signed. King Hussein of Jordan passed on due to cancer. King Abdullah replaced him, Prince Abdullah. Now the new king of Jordan is King Abdullah. Barak won the prime ministership in a landslide. The AIPAC dropped its opposition to a Palestinian state. The Oslo II agreement added, the Sharm el-Sheikh memorandum was added to the Oslo II agreement, dealing with the release of prisoners, further redeployment, and a safe passage from the West Bank to Gaza. German President Johannes Rau visited Israel and apologized to the Israeli people and the Jewish people for the treatment that the Jewish people received from Germany during World War II. Pope John Paul II visited Israel, fulfilling a lifelong dream to walk where Jesus walked. In May 9th, 2000, just as the Israel Independence Day came up, the population of Israel was around 6 million people. And now in 2000, during Israel, to compete with Israel Independence Day, the Palestinian Authority put together the a new day of memorial for the Palestinians called the Nakba Day, or the Catastrophe Day. The day that Israel was instituted was considered the great catastrophe for the Palestinians, and therefore demonstrations have followed ever since. With tensions high in the Middle East, Bill Clinton convened the Camp David talks between Ehud Barak on the left and Yasser Arafat on the right to try and diffuse the tensions and reach some solid movement, experience some solid movement in the peace talks. The Camp David talks were a dismal failure. And they were a dismal failure because Yasser Arafat refused any compromise. Ehud Barak offered him 96% of what he wanted. And this is the Camp David Israeli proposal. 96% of the West Bank territory is the light green and dark green. That would be Palestinian territory. The Israelis would only keep control of a security swath, a security strip along the Jordan River, and two roadways going through the center of the Palestinian state over to two of the major settlement areas. That was turned down by Yasser Arafat. And also the fact that Jerusalem would be the capital of this new Palestinian state. And that was turned down by Yasser Arafat as well. So the Camp David Accord was non-existent. No fruition. Then Likud Chairman Ariel Sharon visited the Temple Mount, and that brings us to our new material. In the year 2000, the Al-Aqsa Intifada begins, also known as the Battle for Jerusalem. So just after Sharon left the compound, after Ariel Sharon left the Temple Mount, a demonstration ensued with 25 Israeli policemen and 4 Muslim rioters injured. In a frank admission, one of the WAF officials, now the WAF is the Muslim organization controlling and managing the Temple Mount. A WAF official later described the rioters as those who came here to cause trouble and not to pray. The demonstrations quickly spread to Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. IDF outposts and Israeli civilians came under attack from stone-throwing youths, armed Tanzim, and even PA security forces. The U.S. State Department blamed the violence on Sharon's visit. The French government issued a statement condemning the visit as a deliberate provocation. And Sharon very rightly rejected the accusation, stating, quote, the disturbances are part of an overall premeditated campaign which began 10 days ago near Netzarim and spread from there to Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria. Sharon asserted that any Israeli has a right to visit the Temple Mount, and he publicly stated that any Arab could visit Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial, without permission, and for that matter, of course, any German tourist can do the same. Israeli analysts felt that the Palestinian extremists had been looking for any excuse to initiate hostilities over Al-Aqsa. This was also voiced by Yair Darwish, a Palestinian professional. He stated that the Palestinian people were so frustrated by the failing peace talks that they were primed to explode. His statement, quote, Sharon was the match, but there was already gasoline poured all over the situation. And he was quite right. Yasser Arafat had poured gasoline all over the situation and was looking for the match. And Ariel Sharon just provided the opportunity for the spark. The Mitchell Report of May 4th, 2001, about a year later, would state that its investigation determined that the riots did not break out as a result of Ariel Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount. They had been pre-planned long before. Now, the two sides seemed close to a ceasefire on Saturday when a tragic event ignited the flames even further. In Gaza, on Saturday, a French TV crew filmed an Arab man and his frightened 12-year-old son, Rami Al-Dura, caught in a crossfire. They were huddling behind a low stone wall. The boy was hit and died in his father's arms, and the father was also wounded and in shock. And here is the pictures by that TV crew of the Rami Al-Dura incident. You can see 12-year-old Rami and his father huddling behind this stone wall. And then Rami is hit by a bullet and dies in his father's arms. His father is also wounded. An initial IDF review of the footage concluded that the two were likely hit by IDF fire, but noted that Israeli forces could not directly see the pair. Well, how could they be hit by IDF fire if the IDF can't even see them? You know, bullets don't go around corners. If you can't see your target, you can't hit your target. So that seems like a crazy admission by the IDF. The IDF said that the soldiers were returning fire on a Palestinian machine gun nest immediately behind Rami and his father. A thorough IDF investigation issued 3 weeks later, a little too late, unfortunately, confirmed by a German TV crew, showed that the bullets that hit the boy came from the directions of a Palestinian gunman who had attacked the Israeli guard post. So Rami was killed by a fellow Palestinian. However, the tragedy inflamed the Palestinians and also Israeli Arabs, who took to the streets as well. And there were riots in Jaffa, Haifa, and Nazareth. These internal riots stunned the Israeli police by their size and their intensity. Israeli sources claimed that Arafat on Friday, the day before, at his Ramallah office, met with leaders of the Tanzim, the Fatah's youth paramilitary group, and the Tanzim are led by Marwan Barghouti. This is Marwan Barghouti. Those present were given to understand by Arafat that there was a need to continue the disturbances in a way that would result in a significant number of fatalities among both Israelis and Palestinians. And notice, at the same time, Arafat promised Prime Minister Ehud Barak that he would act in order to return calm to the streets. So this is just another example of Arafat's duplicity. And when he's talking to the Palestinians, he's saying we need more fatalities. When he's talking to the Israelis, he says we're going to work for peace. He was a very, very shrewd and brutal individual. Well, there was a media bias evident in the media coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That media bias is with us today, but it was really accentuated by this one example. On the day the Intifada broke out, Tuvia Grossman was riding in a taxi to visit the Western Wall. He was unwittingly thrust into the international limelight and nearly killed in the process. On September 30th, 2000, the New York Times, the Associated Press, and other major media outlets published a photo of a young man, bloodied and battered, crouching beneath a club-wielding Israeli policeman. The caption identified the young man as a Palestinian victim of the recent riots, with the clear implication that the Israeli soldier was the one who beat him. Here's that picture in the major media, with the caption, "An Israeli policeman and a Palestinian on the Temple Mount." The victim's true identity was revealed when Dr. Aaron Grossman of Chicago sent the following letter to the Times, and I quote, "Regarding your picture on page A5 of the Israeli soldier and the Palestinian on the Temple Mount, that Palestinian was actually my son, Tuvia Grossman." And you can see that this is Tuvia very clearly in both photographs. Tuvia Grossman, a Jewish student from Chicago. He and two of his friends were pulled from their taxi cab while traveling in Jerusalem by a mob of Palestinian Arabs and were severely beaten and stabbed. The picture could not have been taken on the Temple Mount because there are no gas stations on the Temple Mount and certainly none with Hebrew lettering like the one clearly seen behind the Israeli soldier attempting to protect my son from the mob. And here's a picture of the Temple Mount. Do you see any gas stations on the Temple Mount? Do you see any cars lined up to get gas up there? So preposterous. Crazy. In response, the New York Times published a half-hearted correction which identified Tuvia Grossman as an American student in Israel, not as a Jew beaten by Arabs. The correction, the so-called correction, also noted that Mr. Grossman was wounded in Jerusalem's Old City, although the beating actually occurred in the Arab neighborhood of Wadi el-Yaz, not the Old City. In response to public outrage at the original error and the inaccurate and inadequate correction, the New York Times reprinted Tuvia Grossman's picture, this time with the proper caption, along with a full article indicating his near lynching at the hands of Palestinian rioters. And again, as I said, this anti-Israel bias is still with us today. October 12, 2000, two Israeli reservists are lynched. Two IDF reserve soldiers, Corporal Vadim Novoshesh and Sergeant Major Yosef Avrahami, took a wrong turn as they headed toward their military base at Beit El near Ramallah. They were stopped at a PA roadblock. In the past, the Palestinian police have simply turned back Israeli soldiers who have lost their way. Instead, the Palestinian police arrested the Israelis at gunpoint and ordered them to drive to the Ramallah police station. After arriving at the station, word got out that the Palestinian police were holding several Israeli soldiers, and the rumor included the false information that they may be part of an undercover unit designed to hunt Palestinian fugitives. You see, the men were not in uniform. And that it's not unusual for reserve soldiers who usually get their uniforms when they get to the base. The IDF got word of the problem and immediately contacted PA's liaison officials asking that the soldiers be urgently rescued. By then, an angry mob of more than 1,000 Palestinians had surrounded the police station. Palestinian witnesses say police tried to hold back the crowd and that 15 Palestinian police officers were hurt in the melee. About a dozen men climbed into the police station through a window, and a few minutes later, gunshots were heard. Two men then appeared at the window, sticking their bloody hands out. And there it is. There's one of the young men with bloodied hands at the window that gave the rioters access to the police station. Footage from the Italian Mediaset TV channel showed one of the soldiers dangling upside down from a rope from a window, and the body was dropped into the crowd below. And there is the body hanging and being dropped to the crowd. The crowd then attacked the body and then dragged it through the streets. The second soldier was then thrown out the door, and the two bodies were later handed over to the army. That day, Israel used attack helicopters for the first time to attack Palestinian Authority installations. By the end of June, 15 Palestinian suspects had been arrested for involvement in the lynching. Aziz Salha, 20 years old, was in custody. He had been seen waving his bloodied hands from the police station window. Pretty clear identification, I would say. Unfortunately, the brutality of the lynching surfaced in the midst of the Jerusalem police force itself in May. The same sort of brutality surfaced, but not as extreme. On May 7th, Jerusalem policemen, including one officer, were indicted for beating a man taken in by the army as a suspect in the Ramallah lynching. The policemen beat the prisoner because they thought he was the one filmed with blood on his hands. In October, the Italian television station apologized to the PA for filming the lynching. The footage aired on several stations around the world, and the PA had threatened the life of the Italian crew members. You know, you film our riots, we'll kill you. You put our riots up on the media, and we'll kill you. Don't you dare film our riots. Isn't that amazing? And this was because the story was all over the media. It's a very well-known picture of the lynching. Here's how it appeared on the cover of U.S. News and World Report. October 16, 2000, the Sharm el-Sheikh summit. U.S. President Bill Clinton, Egyptian President Mubarak, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and PA Chairman Yasser Arafat began an emergency summit meeting at the Sharm el-Sheikh in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. The summit was a contentious 28-hour failure. Mr. Barak and Mr. Arafat never negotiated directly. They did shake hands and sit in a civil manner during the sessions and at the meals. However, they negotiated through Mr. Mubarak of Egypt and Mr. Clinton of the United States. Before the summit, Barak expressed strong doubts that Arafat was still interested in reaching a peace agreement. Quote, "He launched a wave of violence in the last few weeks when it was clear that there was on the table a possible framework agreement which reflects further flexibility of the Israelis even in the past, and he chose not to go for it." The summit closed with a statement read by President Clinton announcing that both sides had agreed on two major items. Number one, to end the violence. And number two, to set up an international fact-finding committee into the cause of the violence. Prime Minister Barak said the true test of the Sharm el-Sheikh conference would be whether the violence ends. Now, the ceasefire was only 1 hour old, and senior PA officials were leading several hundred chanting protesters on a march through Ramallah to protest the agreement. Marwan Barghouti was adamant that the Al-Aqsa Intifada would continue. And from there, it only got worse. A protracted firefight broke out in the West Bank after Palestinian militants opened fire on Israeli settler families out on a Sukkot holiday hike. In June 2001, Clinton blamed Arafat for the failure of the peace process. Clinton stated that 3 days prior to the end of his presidency, Arafat called to say goodbye. "He told me I was a great man." An example of Arafat's duplicity and flattery. "I told him I wasn't, that I was a gigantic failure, and that it was his fault." Clinton described Arafat as an aging leader who was incapable of making the right decision to commit himself to the peace process. Clinton later shared that at Camp David he told Arafat that by turning down the best peace deal he was ever going to get, he was guaranteeing the election of hawkish Ariel Sharon, and President Clinton was correct on that assessment. quite correct. Now let's take a look at the youthful face of the Intifada. Now the young men of the Tanzim are at the forefront of the Al-Aqsa Intifada. Even as Palestinian officials accuse Israel of overreacting to peaceful demonstrations, they're encouraging and facilitating youthful participation. And why? Why? Because the televised pictures of 13, 14, and 15-year-olds carried off the battlefields, bloodied and unconscious, is a powerful public relations weapon. Arafat called for renewed resistance by the young activists. Often, the children go straight from school to the site of the demonstration. In Ramallah, a man raced toward a line of Israeli soldiers shouting, "Allah Akbar, God is great," while holding in front of him a little boy about 2 years old. The child's head was wrapped in a green Hamas kerchief inscribed with the sentence, "There is no God but Allah." According to traditional Islamic belief, a shaheed, a martyr for the faith, will receive 72 virgins as wives in heaven. And there's a mystical belief that Allah favors the martyr. Now, women are not excluded from this kind of action. The PA's leading official is the leading newspaper is Al Hayat Al Hayadiyah. That's the Palestinian, the PA's leading official newspaper, Al Hayat Al Hayadiyah. The editor-in-chief wrote a signed editorial denouncing as corrupt and disgusting anyone who counsels self-preservation to Palestinian youth, including their own fathers. So if you're a Palestinian teenager and you say, well, I don't think I want to join the riots and get killed, or if you have a son, you're a father, and you have a son, and you say to your son, "Son, I'd rather you not join the demonstrations. You could get hurt and killed." That is corrupt and disgusting, according to this editor. Now, the situation is very disturbing among Israeli soldiers. Sergeant Hillel Gubenko, himself only 19, stated, "You kind of feel frustrated when children are throwing rocks. You don't want to shoot them, but people hiding behind them are shooting at you." Now, speaking to an Egyptian newspaper, the Arafat-appointed Mufti of Jerusalem and Palestine, Sheikh Ikrima Sabri, stated in an interview, and this is the Mufti of Jerusalem and Palestine, Ikrima Said Sabri, in the interview. The interview went like this. Question: "What do you feel when you pray for the soul of the martyrs?" Sabri: "I feel the martyr is lucky, because the angels usher him to his wedding in heaven. I feel the earth moves under the occupier's feet." Well, I don't see the Mufti on the front lines of the demonstrations. He could participate in the good luck by getting killed and gaining 72 virgins himself. But as far as I know, he never joined the demonstrations. Question: "Is it different when the martyr is a child?" Sabri: "Yes, it is. It's hard to express it in words. There's no doubt that the child martyr suggests that the new generation will carry on the mission with determination. The younger the martyr, the greater, and the more I respect him. I talked to a young man who said, 'I want to marry the black-eyed,'" that means the beautiful, "'the black-eyed women of heaven.' The next day he became a martyr. I am sure his mother was filled with joy about this heavenly marriage. Such a son must have such a mother." May 2001, the American Academy of Pediatrics issued a statement denouncing the Palestinians for using their children as human shields. The statement was initiated by a group of 200 doctors called Doctors Against Child Sacrifice. Now, the tragedy of hatred is emphasized during mid-2002 when the photo of a baby bomber was discovered in the home of a suspected terrorist. A toddler was photographed in a mock suicide uniform, complete with sticks of explosives and the traditional martyr's red headband. The family stated that the photograph was just a joke. It was just a prank. Nothing serious. Well, I think that there's something much more serious underlying this photograph. The photograph emphasizes how pervasively the Palestinians are training their children to hate Israel and the Israelis. That's the underlying problem in this photograph. The Shahid, the martyr, has become a prominent role model for young men in Palestinian society. Palestinian Labor Minister Ghassan Khatib stated that the IDF distributed the picture to, quote, tell the world that the Palestinians are teaching their children how to hate Israel and how to act against Israel. And I just want to say this is correct. This is correct. He said that's exactly what's happening in the Palestinian area. The Palestinians are teaching their children to hate Israelis and hate Israel. A Palestinian journalist in Hebron said this kind of photograph was common because many of the children imitate the adults. Other Palestinian officials dismissed the photo as a propaganda trick. Well, here's another Palestinian photo. It's made into quite a poster there, isn't it? I like the bottom statement. Not everyone gets to be an astronaut when they grow up. If they grow up. Palestinian school books are likewise geared to fan the flames of hatred. Israel examined 23 school books intended for children in first and second grades, as well as the fifth and sixth grade. The books delegitimize Israel and claim that the Palestinians have first rights to the territory. They claim that Arab Canaanites were in the land before the Jews, and therefore Zionist claims to the land are a lie. Well, if you want to align yourself with the Canaanites, even though that's impossible, the Canaanites are stated in the Bible to be a corrupt and depraved group of people that God gave over 400 years of grace to change their ways, and then gave the land to the Jewish people who routed them out of the land. If you want to identify yourself with the Canaanites, you're identifying yourself with a morally depraved people. In addition to the heavenly rewards promised the martyrs, there was also financial compensations. Iraq offers $25,000 to the families of terrorists. Saudi Arabia awards families $5,000 each. Finally, according to Israeli sources, Palestinian terrorist recruiters visit terminally ill patients in cancer wards and offer money to their families as well. Hey, you're going to die anyway of cancer. You might as well go out in glory and financially benefit your families. Strap on a suicide belt. Blow yourself up. Kill some Israelis. Die with glory, not from cancer. Quite a worldview, isn't it? Probably the most hypocritical position is taken by Yasser Arafat's wife. Arafat's wife, Suha Al-Tawil, has publicly endorsed suicide bombings. And here's Suha Arafat in an interview with London-based Saudi-owned Al-Mayala magazine. Mrs. Arafat said if she had a son, she would consider it an honor to sacrifice him for the Palestinian cause. And quote, would you expect me and my children to be less patriotic and more eager to live than my countrymen and their father and leader who is seeking martyrdom? Mrs. Arafat lives in Switzerland with her daughter. She has no son. She has no son to honorably sacrifice for the Palestinian people. And she's so patriotic that she's living outside the land in Paris and Switzerland. My, what hypocrisy. Well, the use of children is not new. The first PLO use of children in warfare was Lebanon in 1982. And how do I know this? Well, in 2002, I spent 3 weeks in Israel as a volunteer with the IDF Sarel program. And this is their website, Volunteers for Israel. An evening lecture was delivered by Sergeant Major Israel. And here I am, oh, by the way, here I am as a Sarel volunteer in the program in 2002. I'm in my IDF uniform. And this is the group, the Sarel group, that I went with. There I am in the front row of the picture. So we were in Israel volunteering for the IDF. in 2002, and an evening lecture was delivered by Major Israel. And here is Major Israel. He spoke of his experience in Lebanon in 1982 and the post-traumatic stress syndrome that has dogged him ever since. He lost 11 men because the PLO used children to launch rockets at Israeli tanks. Now, the IDF pursues a purity of arms doctrine. They do all they can to avoid injuring civilians. The anxiety was horrible because those you try to avoid hurting are killing your men. Then he was severely wounded, losing an eye, a leg, and suffering a severely damaged arm. All he can remember is feeling hot all over his body and then waking up in the hospital. His pregnant wife subsequently divorced him and told their son after he was born that their father was dead. Well, fortunately, years later, Major Israel was united with his son. Since his recovery, he's earned 2 college degrees, although he still has a hard time going into crowds and marketplaces. A documentary was done on Israeli TV telling his story of partial recovery. So he is an eyewitness. He is an eyewitness to the first use of children in warfare by the PLO. Nothing new. Began in 1982. All right, November 2000, Israeli targets terrorists. In November, Israeli helicopter gunships, and this is an example, this is an AH-64 Apache helicopter gunship. Israeli helicopter gunship successfully attacked Hussein Abayat, a senior leader of the Tanzim militia that has spearheaded the current intifada. His death was the first assassination of a senior member of Fatah, is Arafat's political organization. Hussein al-Sheikh, one of the leaders of the movement, stated, "We in Fatah consider ourselves in a state of war with Israel." The U.S. has consistently condemned Israel's targeting of terrorists. Lieutenant General Shaul Mofaz defended the policy in July 2001 by stating, "What would you do if 40 suicide attacks were carried out against your country? What would you do? World, what would you do, USA?" November 12, 2000, Leah Rabin dies at 72. Leah Rabin, the widow of the late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, died of cancer. She was buried at Mount Herzl Military Cemetery in Jerusalem next to her husband. And this is the Yitzhak and Leah Rabin's grave on Mount Herzl. November 26, 2000, international inquiry into the Intifada begins. Now, this is deja vu, isn't it? We've seen so many international inquiries into the life of the nation Israel. Remember way back to number one, the Commission of Inquiry in 1921, number two, the Royal Commission in 1930 that issued the Shaw Report. Number three, the Peel Commission in 1937. Number four, the Palestinian Partition Commission, 1938. Number five, the UNSCOP investigations, 1947. It just never seems to stop. It never seems to stop. February 26, 2001. Ariel Sharon elected Israel's prime minister. Ariel Sharon was elected Israel's 11th prime minister in a landslide vote over Labor candidate Ehud Barak. And here is Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Ariel Sharon is very nationalist in outlook. He was a former defense general and defense minister. In his swearing-in ceremony, he stated that he was prepared for peace, but he would insist on reduction in violence before resuming negotiations. He took his oath of office with his hand on a Hebrew Old Testament, a first for an Israeli prime minister. His aides said the gesture symbolically reaffirmed the Jewish connection to the Holy Land. In March, he asserted his goal was to increase Aliyah, immigration. His goal by 2020 was that most of the Jewish nation would be gathered to the State of Israel. Knesset returns to the parliamentary system. In 1996, the electoral system that consisted of separate ballots for prime minister and for party in the government was repealed on March 7th, 2001. Now the Israelis vote strictly for the party. the European Union to monitor PA funds. EU representatives stated that they plan to closely monitor funds transferred to the PA in order to ensure that they do not end up in Yasser Arafat's pockets. The concern about financial abuse is well founded. On May 5, 2002, Israel released a 91-page report entitled The Arafat File. The report demonstrated that Yasser Arafat and top PA officials were directly involved in financing terror attacks. Money provided by the PA to the PA by donor states such as the EU and the USA was allocated to finance terror and incitement. Tens of millions of dollars were used to pay terrorists. On June 7, 2002, the Kuwaiti Al-Watan daily newspaper published the fact that they had received documents from private sources and called the transfer a theft. The documents show that Yasser Arafat had deposited in his name $5.1 million into a personal account for personal expenses and upkeep for his family. Remember, his wife and daughter live in Switzerland, and I would think rather grandly with $5.1 million in your bank account. March 29, 2001, the IDF opens offensive operations against Force 17. Three successful terrorist bombing attacks struck Israel late in March. Following the wave of terrorism that struck Israel, the government convened an emergency security cabinet meeting. During the meeting, it was decided to undertake consistent, protracted campaign against terrorists, their accomplices, and their commanders. No longer would Israel move in relation to incidents, Prime Minister Sharon stated, the day for restraint is over. IDF helicopter gunships, again, here's another representative picture, attacked five targets of Force 17, Yasser Arafat's personal presidential guard. Force 17 targets hit, one in Ramallah, four in Gaza. The attacks were driven by neither punishment nor revenge, but by the right of Israel to self-defense. The attacks were Prime Minister Sharon's first military response since he took office 3 weeks earlier. Hatzofay, an Israeli right-wing newspaper, commented, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was elected in order to put a stop to the shedding of Israeli citizens' blood, which his predecessor failed to do. No benefit will accrue to Israel for showing restraint because the Arab world sees this as weakness. Now, this is a very, very important point for the Western world to understand. The Arab worldview is that might makes right. If you are strong, you take what you want. If you are weak, you compromise. Okay? The Western outlook is exactly the opposite. For us, compromise is good. Compromise is strength. Compromise is desirable. But in the Arab world, compromise is humiliating. You're admitting that you're weak and defeated if you compromise. So when Israel tries to negotiate, tries to enter into compromise and negotiation, she's viewed as weak. All right, May 14, 2001, Israel Independence Day. In May 14th, the Jewish population was 5.2 million, the Arab population 1.0 million, and so the total population of Israel was about 6.2 million. Just a note, the Arab population in the West Bank and Gaza is about 3.2 million. April 24, 2001, the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, hits the lowest level ever. On April 24, 2001, the lake was at the red line, a minus 213 meters below the normal level. If the water drops three more meters to a minus 216 meters below the normal level, Israel's water supply will be endangered and the lake could suffer irreparable ecological damage. At present, water can only be supplied from natural resources that have become seriously depleted after 3 consecutive years of drought. Now, this is the area along the Sea of Galilee called Tabkha. Tabkha, this is a church and a tourist site. The point I want to make for showing you this picture is the water level. Notice the water level in the Sea of Galilee. It's at its normal filled level. This is the filled Sea of Galilee. Now, notice that rock. See that rock there? Pay attention to that rock. Now, here is the picture in 2009 when I visited Tabkha. And guess what I'm looking at? I'm looking at that rock, now covered by a bush that has grown up on and around it. But notice where that rock is sitting. That rock is sitting high and dry on the beach. This line is approximately where the water should be when the lake is filled. I should have been standing neck deep or underwater to take this picture. The lake is down a tremendous level here, looking down the beach at Tabkha. You can see how far the water has receded. All the people on the left in the foreground should be underwater, should be neck deep, at least in water. And looking down the beach in the other direction, you can see how low the lake is. Now, here's a graph of the Kinneret water levels from 2004 to 2012. This graph is a little later than the time frame we're looking at here, 2001. But the upper line is the upper red line, the minus 213 meters below the normal level. So that's the first red line. Below it is the second red line, a minus 213 meters below sea level. Below that is the black line, which is a minus 216 meters below sea level. And it's that black line that's the danger level. The water ever goes below that black line, there could be ecological damage to the Sea of Galilee. Apparently, there are underground saline springs that are held in check by the fresh water on the top of them. But when the water level gets below the minus 216 feet level, then the springs begin to ooze up into the Sea of Galilee and begin to pollute the fresh water with the saline water. That's the problem. And you can see the graph, how the water level of the Sea of Galilee goes up and down with the seasons. And the problem, what we're looking at, is right here, where it is below the second red line, yet just barely above the black line. That's the crucial problem for water in the Sea of Galilee, because the Sea of Galilee is Israel's largest and natural reservoir for fresh water that's used extensively. All right, May 4th, 2001, the Mitchell Report is issued. The Sharm el-Sheikh Fact-Finding Committee, also known as the Mitchell Committee, issued its report regarding the cause of the Al-Aqsa Intifada on May 4th, 2001. The report concluded that the violence was caused by 2 factors. Number 1, divergent expectations. The government of Israel expects that the Oslo process, guess what? The Oslo process that they signed would proceed in a nonviolent atmosphere consistent with the agreements between the parties. The PLO expected faster implementation of the Oslo Accords. Well, that's no excuse for violence. Just because it's not proceeding along as quickly as you want is no excuse for violence. Secondly, divergent perspectives. Each side views the other as acting in bad faith and claims that the other side has failed to comply with the agreements. So the basic recommendations of the Mitchell Report are, number 1, cessation of violence. Number 2, resumption of security cooperation. 3, rebuild confidence. And they mentioned 10 points. Number 1, the PA must take all measures necessary to stop terrorist operations. Number 2, the PA must arrest and jail all terrorists operating within its jurisdiction. Those are 2 points that can only be carried out by the PA. Then there's a point that to be carried out by the government of Israel. The government of Israel must freeze all settlement construction. And the remaining 7 points fell on both governments. Number 4, both sides must implement a cooling off period. Number 5, both sides must reduce tensions and prevent violent demonstrations. Number 6, both sides must discipline their actions and responses. Number 7, both sides must foster understanding and tolerance and abstain from incitement. Number 8, both sides must minimize the economic and social impact of the violence. Number 9, both sides must respect the holy places. And number 10, there will be no international protection force intervening or introduced unless both sides support it. And finally, the 4th point was resume negotiations. Well, the Palestinians accepted the report and declared that they wanted to use it as a basis to reconvene the American-led Sharm el-Sheikh talks. In addition, they stated that they were ready for an immediate ceasefire based on the principles laid down in the report. Israel likewise gave the okay to the Mitchell Report with 2 reservations. 1, the demand for an absolute settlement freeze, and 2, its criticism of IDF operations. The United States endorsed the report and urged both sides to cease violence immediately as a first step toward restoring trust. In response, on May 23, 2001, Ariel Sharon halted all IDF preemptive strikes against the PA and will maintain the ceasefire except in cases of genuine danger to human life. He urged the PA to agree to immediate ceasefire. The Palestinian Authority continued to carry out acts of terrorism and violence with greater intensity. From May 23rd, when the Israeli ceasefire was ordered, until May 29th, 1 week, there were 96 terrorist attacks. So much for endorsing the Mitchell Report by the Palestinian Authority. By June 2001, a tenuous ceasefire had been established. June 6, 2001, CIA Director George Tenet is sent to the Middle East. With the ceasefire more or less holding, President Bush sent CIA Director George Tenet to the region to mediate a round of security talks. The focus of Director Tenet's visit will be the unwillingness of the PA to arrest terrorists. The government of Israel has given the PA a list of 34 Hamas and Islamic Jihad activists it wants arrested. The PA retorted, "The arrest of Palestinian activists," note they don't use the word terrorist, "the arrest of Palestinian activists is unequivocally unacceptable." Israel had already begun to implement the settlement freeze by not approving additional construction of settlements and by ordering IDF to dismantle all new outposts set up by settlers. So it sounds to me like the IDF is trying, like Israel is trying to abide by the agreement, but the Palestinians are unequivocally opposed to implementing the agreement. The PA said the freeze formula worked out by the American government was a trick. There you go. They don't want to cooperate. On June 12, 2001, Prime Minister Sharon accepted the ceasefire security plan put forward by CIA Director Tenet. Yasser Arafat gave reluctant approval to Tenet plan only after Director Tenet threatened to leave the region. What happened? However, the violence and the terrorism continued. For example, July 18, 2001, the first mortar shells fall on Jerusalem. Then on August 1, 2001, Israel strikes against Hamas. August 27, 2001, Israel strikes against the PFLP. You know, Israel can only put up with this terrorism for so long, and then it's time to react, time to return fire. So August 27, 2001, Israel strikes against the PFLP. Israeli helicopters fired rockets at a building in PA-ruled Ramallah, killing the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The victim, Abu Ali Mustafa, was the highest-ranking PA official killed by Israel in the past 11 months. He was one of the top 5 figures in the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Israel defended her actions on the basis of self-defense. Why? Why? Because the PFLP was responsible for dozens of terrorist attacks against Israelis, and Mustafa was involved in preparing additional terrorist attacks against Israel. Mustafa had returned to Palestine territories from exile in 1999. Israel had allowed him to return on the condition he would renounce terrorist activity and embrace the peace process. The PA guaranteed they would restrain his activities. Did they? No, not at all. Even so, the United States sharply condemned Israel for Mustafa's death. September 10, 2001, the first Israeli Arab suicide bomber. Up till now, they'd all been Palestinian Arabs. September 11th, 2001, Islamic terrorists attack New York and Washington, D.C. And this is one of the very famous pictures of the World Trade Center burning after the airplanes had smashed into the towers. Israel's reaction. Israel observed a national day of mourning in solidarity with the U.S. after the deadly terrorist attacks against the World Trade Center and against the Pentagon. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon told Americans, "Our hearts are with you and we're ready to provide any assistance at any time." Israel declared Wednesday a day of mourning and set up a blood bank for the injured. Ariel Sharon continued, "This is a war between good and evil and between humanity and the bloodthirsty," said Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. He added that the attacks would be a turning point in the war against international terror. The government buildings in Israel lowered their flags in half-mast in solidarity with the United States. And here, candles and banners are being lit and placed outside the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv, Israel, by the average Israeli. The average Israeli understood what we were going through. And here's a picture of schoolgirls in Palestine praying in a moment of silence. In contrast, 4,000 Palestinians took to the streets in Nablus to celebrate the attacks. Now, realizing the celebrations would shock the world, the PA police quelled the celebrations and confiscated videotape of the cameraman who filmed it. Yasser Arafat's Tanzim militiamen threatened the life of a Palestinian cameraman working for the Associated Press. They told him if the footage was shown, he would die. Don't you dare show the truth. Don't you dare photograph the truth of what goes on in the Palestinian territories. The Foreign Press Association sharply criticized the PA for suppressing the videotape of the Palestinian celebrations in Nablus and other areas. Celebrations by Hamas members occurred in Gaza City, Ramallah, and Jericho. And here's another example of Arafat's duplicity, saying one thing out of one side of his mouth and another thing out of the other side of his mouth. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat said, "I send my condolences and the condolences of the Palestinian people." Yeah, the 4,000 at Nablus and the others at Gaza, Ramallah, and Jericho? The condolences of the Palestinian people, sure. To American President Bush and his government and to the American people for this terrible act, Arafat told reporters in Gaza. "We can completely condemn this serious operation. We were completely shocked. It's unbelievable, unbelievable, unbelievable," says the visibly upset Arafat. Sure, right. Conspiracy theories in the Arab world said Israel was behind the attack. Rumors ran wild. Rumor number one, 4,000 Jews who worked in the Trade Center were mysteriously absent on September 11th. In response to that rumor, let me share the experience of Mark Sokolow. He was working on the 38th floor of the South Tower. His office was evacuated, and he escaped unharmed before the second plane hit the North Tower. Nobody ever told him to stay home from work that day. He was conspicuously present. Ironically, later, on January 27, 2002, he and his wife Rina and their daughters were shopping in Jerusalem and suffered minor injuries from a nearby suicide bomber. Can you believe that? Mark Sokolow and his family experienced near misses by two terrorist attacks. Poor guy. Now, in contrast, September11news.com reported that not a single Saudi lost their life in the Trade Center towers. Well, let's not forget the Saudi terrorists. Ironically, we know that a number of the hijackers were Saudis. Okay, that's rumor number one. Rumor number two. Five Jews were arrested after being spotted videotaping the attack and dancing in celebration. Rumor number three. The Al-Watan Qatar newspaper named Ariel Sharon as the brains behind the attack. Number four, rumor number four. The Gulf News, a daily newspaper of the United Arab Emirates, reported Salim Abu Sultan, a Palestinian diplomat, as stating, quote, "I can smell Israeli fingers behind this. The scope of the attack was beyond the capability of Arabs. Only Israelis have the ability to do such things." In other words, Arabs are a bunch of dolts. We couldn't have possibly pulled that off. We're too stupid. The Israelis are the only ones smart enough to do something like that. What a statement. Rumor number five. Many Muslims blamed Israel's spy agency, the Mossad. On September 18, 2001, yielding to diplomatic pressure, Arafat ordered his forces to halt all violence directed at Israeli targets. Israel responded by halting military strikes, withdrawing several tank positions, and halting the targeted killing of terrorists. The PA stated they would be working hard to make the truce stick. Hamas stated that they'd be willing to suspend attacks inside of Israel unless provoked. The Israelis were skeptical about Arafat's intentions. Spokesman Dore Gold stated, "In the past, his ceasefires have had a shelf life of roughly 1 week. However, by September 24th, a mere 6 days after Arafat had ordered his ceasefire, 99 terrorist attacks had occurred." So much for compliance with pressure to stop the terrorism. October 17, 2001, Cabinet Minister Rehavam Zvi is assassinated. The PFLP claimed responsibility for the assassination of the Minister of Tourism, and this is Rehavam Zvi. It was the first assassination of a cabinet minister in Israel's 53-year history. November 26, 2001, General Zinni arrives in Israel. Retired U.S. Marine General Anthony Zinni arrived in Israel in an attempt to mediate a ceasefire. He unsuccessfully attempted to prod Mr. Arafat into initiating a meaningful crackdown against Hamas and Islamic Jihad. General Zinni gave Arafat a list of 30 Palestinian extremists to arrest. The PA picked up only 12. Of the 12, only a few were placed under real arrest. After 3 fruitless weeks, General Zinni was recalled because Palestinian terror attacks continued unabated. December 13, 2001. Israel severs ties with Arafat and calls him irrelevant. In an emergency meeting following a deadly terror attack near the Emmanuel settlement, the cabinet declared PA Chairman Arafat no longer relevant. The cabinet approved military operations against the terror infrastructure in the West Bank and Gaza. Yasser Arafat will not be harmed, and every effort will be made to avoid injury to Palestinian civilians. Water, food, electricity, and fuel will continue to be supplied. There's not going to be a siege of the West Bank or anything like that. Israel feels that the Oslo Accords were still in effect and that Arafat is not fulfilling the terms of the agreement to fight terror. Accordingly, Israeli tanks stationed themselves 200 yards from Arafat's headquarters in Ramallah, effectively trapping him in the facility. The IDF also toppled the Voice of Palestine radio antenna. The PA called Israel's actions declarations of war against the PA. Well, Israel has never declared war on the Palestinian people. Its actions have always been based on self-defense. Israel is fed up because this is the ninth ceasefire initiative embraced by Mr. Arafat that has failed. U.S. President Bush bluntly assailed Arafat for failing to end the violence, and this was a distinct change. Up to this point, President Bush called for both sides to end the violence. Now the focus of responsibility was shifted squarely onto the shoulders of Arafat. In response, Yasser Arafat called for a complete cessation of armed attacks and military activities. His remarks were directed at Islamic Jihad and the PFLP. Arafat stated that he had reached an agreement with Hamas to suspend suicide and mortar attacks. Israel, who wants results, not words, found that nothing has changed. Statistics revealed that attacks had only dropped from 18 per day to 11 per day. Accordingly, Israel kept Arafat penned up in his Ramallah office, refusing to allow him to attend Christmas Eve services in Bethlehem. The Christmas Eve services in Bethlehem are a great propaganda outlet for Yasser Arafat. Few Arab leaders offered him support. Israel stated that his confinement would end if he became a constructive partner for peace. Israel still insisted he must arrest the assassins of Rahavam Zvi. All right, let's close our session with this comment. We're a little over time, but we only had a minute or so left. December 31st, 2001. 2001 is the most difficult year ever. As 2001 drew to a close, the Israeli police determined that it had been the most difficult year with regard to security since Israel had become a state in 1948. Minister of Foreign Affairs Shimon Peres also would comment that 2001 was the most trying time Israel had had to face since its statehood 53 years earlier. In addition, immigration statistics were down as well. Aliyah had dropped by nearly 28% in 2001. The drop in immigration was attributed to the economic situation and the security situation. But despite the drop, 43,477 made Aliyah in 2001. Alrighty, that brings us to the end of our session. We will pick it up next session in. Excuse me, I backed up the wrong way. We'll pick it up in 2002, in January of 2002, with the Karin A. Palestinian freighter being captured. We'll pick it up in the new year in our next session. Thanks so much for being our students. We'll see you next session. Lahithra'ot. Lahithra'ot.